Come to order. It's February 1st, 2012, 1:34 p.m. We have members present, all members. For the good of the order, Representative Edgman.
Thank you for the quick digression here, Mr. Chairman. Just wanted to note that I have a number of my constituents in the audience. It's the same group that I was able to introduce on the House floor today. I'm here observing all facets of the legislature. And I was just told a moment ago that they may actually have to get up and leave during the middle of the meeting. So you see a bunch of people leaving. It's not because of other reasons, just simply because of their schedule.
They're here too. They wanted to hear the university presentation, presumably.
I think that would be the preference, but that's probably not our order today, as I understand it. So I think they're here more just to observe the process than to be in the finance committee room.
And I could hit the eject button on Mr. Savadni. So no other questions. Thank you, Representative, and welcome. Look forward to meeting you after the meeting if we get out of here.
If we get out of here.
So welcome on behalf of the Department of Law. I don't know if you've removed the acting portion of your job.
I didn't do very well at acting, and so it's over today. I'm ready to proceed, Mr. Chairman, if you wish.
You know the protocol, sir.
Thank you. I'd like to thank the co-chairs, the members of the committee, for hearing the overview of the Department of Law. I'm going to start by talking
about... For the record, we know you're not acting.
I'm sorry, sir. Yeah, you just reminded me that I should follow the protocol. My name is Rick Sabodny. I'm the Deputy Attorney General for the Criminal Division. Mr. Garrity, the Attorney General, is not able to be here today because of a longstanding commitment before he moved, a family commitment that was in existence before he knew that that he was going to become part of becoming a public servant. So he did express his desire to talk to you about the cases that I'm about to go over and any issues that you have in regards to the Department of Law. Let me start with our mission. And our mission is to prosecute people who engage in criminal behavior and to provide legal services to state agencies to promote the safety and betterment of Alaskans. We do this through basically four core services, which are to provide financial and safety to our citizens, to provide for an environment where we can have responsible development of our natural resources, to be protect the fiscal the fiscal integrity of the state, and to promote good governance. We do this with as one of the smallest departments in the state, with 573 employees, 295 of which are attorneys. They're divided between the civil and criminal division, 166 for the civil division and 127 for the criminal division. We also hope to do this on a budget of $99 million this year, $2 million of which is the result of a multi-year funding for outside counsel to deal with oil and gas issues. And as I go through these slides, you'll see how important the oil and gas issues are for the Department of Law because of the return it brings to us. Speaking of return, the department is not a income-neutral agency. We bring a return to the state. This last year, it was approximately $144 million. Now, these numbers were pretty easy to calculate. That was how much is the result of legal actions that we took, we were able to bring back to the state of Alaska. There's another unquantifiable number, and that is how much we have saved because of defending tort actions against the state in a professional manner and prevailing in those cases. There's certainly no way of determining the fiscal savings that we engage in when we protect children by removing them from dangerous homes or being able to put them, by terminating parental rights, put them in a place where they can be adopted by loving families. So this is just cash brought into the state. I want to go through the four core services that I talked to you about just a moment ago and talk about some of the cases that have been important to us and important to people of the state in the last year. First, protecting our citizens. As I said, we do that through the prosecution of criminal cases, and we do it through child need of aid, our environmental section, our commercial fair business section. Because I'm the deputy now of the criminal division, we start with criminal division numbers. We processed about 7,500 felony cases last year and 22,000 misdemeanor cases. From the civil division, when we talk about child in need of aid cases, we had a little over 1,000 cases, and then there were 6,100 other cases that dealt with other types of criminal matters like extraditions, appeals, that type of thing. I want to brag a little bit about the our child protection lawyers. There are 26 of them in the state, and doing the work they do is some of the hardest work that you can imagine. They just find kids in terrible situations and have to deal with the emotion of that. But we have been, in the last 17 cases that have gone to the Supreme Court, the child protection section of the Department of Law has prevailed in all of those. So it's an important section, and they do really good work. Both the criminal division and the civil division have been very involved in the governor's initiative to end domestic violence and sexual assault in the next 10 years. As you can imagine, talking about those child in need of aid lawyers, that is oftentimes, if not almost universal, kind of the area that they find themselves in. The cases where they're trying to terminate parental rights are as a result of abuse or neglect that certainly fit in with the governor's initiative to end domestic violence. On the criminal side, I sat down this year and looked at the cold cases that we have done, and only one of those cases, which was kind of gang-related cases, only one of the cases did not deal with either sexual assault or domestic violence. That was a striking thing for me to learn by looking through our statistics. We've been quite a bit involved in trying to bring new services to victims of domestic violence and sexual assault.
We have a question from
Hello.
Thank you. Through the chair, I appreciate you bringing up gang-related violence. And I was just curious, in your experience, are we seeing a rise in gang activity in Alaska? And what do you think can be done about that?
Through the chair, gang activity in Alaska is different than we read about in Time magazine or in the New York Times. The gang activity in Alaska, which is primarily in the Anchorage area, is less homogeneous. I mean, if you talk about Chicago gangs, you talk about gangs with strong ethnic ties to each other. In Anchorage, you see that it's less of an organization, less of a of a, I wanted to say family, but a group that are bound together through some background. We certainly have seen in Anchorage 3 or 4 years ago substantially, I think that we've seen kind of a decline in the last 2 or 3 years, but that doesn't mean it doesn't exist and that there are groups of people who get together and perpetrate violence on other people. And if I may, I think it was 4 or 5 years ago, at the then Lieutenant Governor's request, a person was funded in the Anchorage DA's office to specialize in that area. And there's a special group within the Anchorage Police Department and a special lawyer in the Anchorage DA's office to deal with gang-related offenses.
Mr. Chair, can you just give me a little more information on what the department does on increasing school attendance? I've just never seen that before.
Thank you, Representative Garrett. Through the chair, actually, I was just about to get to that. It is my view and people in the criminal division's view that one of the ways that we can deter domestic violence, sexual assault, is to make sure kids are in school. If they're in school, they're less likely to be in an environment where they're going to be abused. If they're in school and they are abused, they're more likely to be in an environment where they're going to tell somebody. And if they get through school, they're less likely to be offenders themselves. So it's one of the few things that prosecutors can do that is not reactive but proactive. And what we have done is we've had the DA in Bethel and the DA in Nome establish with the local school districts a program for dealing with truancy in Kotzebue and in Barrow. And if you remember, last year we funded an additional prosecutor for each of those communities. I sat down with both of them beforehand, and I talked to them about how this was an important part of their job, and they needed to be spending a lot. They needed to be spending time doing it. It's not something that we like to do. They aren't, they're paper cases in many respects, and then when you get to if you get them before a court, there's not a lot that the court can do. Right now it can impose a fine. We don't want to fine somebody. We want to keep the kids in school. So when I used to do it in Juneau, there'd be maybe kids would be out of school for 2 or 3 months, and there would be a substantial fine, and it would all be suspended on condition you went to summer school. They don't have summer school here in Juneau anymore. We'd like to be able to have a situation where you get a fine, and actually in some, like in Kotzebue, they're doing this, you get a fine, you get $50 off each time you walk your kid to school, or you get $25 off if you go to lunch with your child. And we just need to kind of develop more ways of not sanctioning people, but for rewarding them and keeping kids in school.
Representative Jewell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the previous page, on the numbers for calendar year 2000, of felons of 7,500, misdemeanants of 22,000. And thinking about the last few years of the increase and looking forward, the continued efforts to increase VPSO presence and public safety presence in many of the communities in Alaska that have been without for a while, I'm making an assumption that as that presence shows up in the communities, there's probably some corresponding statistics that are in here as question one. But at 7,500 people, I'm just wondering if we've got space for them all.
Through the chair, Representative Jewell, these because you a case is referred also, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's charged, but a good 90% of these are charged. That doesn't mean that if convicted, you end up in jail. There are a lot of, especially if you're a first-time offender, if you're a second-time offender, there's presumptive sentencing in the state, and you probably do end up doing some time in jail. The question of whether we have enough space for them is probably better addressed to Commissioner Schmidt. I did learn something as acting attorney general. But I think it's also important to note that if you look back for the last 6-7 years in Alaska, our crime rate's been pretty flat. When I graphed it out, it was flat. And then I realized that really means that our crime rate has declined per capita because we have a growth rate of about 1.3 or 1.4% a year. So we have followed the national trend in a downward crime rate. But I really want to emphasize this. The rates for rape nationally are 24 for 100,000 people. In Alaska, it's 75 for 100,000 people per year. Although we have followed the same trend, decline, a little bit of decline, our violent crimes are higher, with the exception of murder, are higher than any place else in the state. We're actually a little bit lower than the average for murder. So.
Well, as Marion Barry said about the city of Washington, the crime rate's not so bad if you don't count the murders.
I just do want to mention one other thing about sexual...
On these issues, though, we've asked the Department of Law Subcommittee, we've asked the Department to provide more elaboration on the disposition of those cases, as well as on the ongoing litigation. They have a real nice graph which has a summary of what the litigation is, when it started, the major issues, what the next step is. So we'll provide those to the full committee, and that'll, as we get that information from the subcommittee, as it'll... Representative Jewell?
Thank you, Mr.
I mean to walk over your time there.
Fine.
Oh, Representative Fairclough, I'm sorry. You're so far away, I didn't see you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First, Rick, thank you for your work on the issue of violence in our communities. I know that you've been a strong advocate to hold people accountable and to help victims of violent crimes for decades, both in rural areas and urban areas. I just didn't want to have the moment pass and not to make sure that when we're talking about trying to reduce violence in our communities, that we're working with our school nurses in the program, because about a decade ago we identified in the Anchorage community a relationship between success in school and truancy. But it seems like it's a great measure that we might be able to tie, and that the governor's task force may be able to use in determining whether we're turning the curb on violence in some communities based on that particular criteria. So anyway, I have many friends who are school nurses, and they know who aren't showing up for school every day, and sometimes they even know why. And they're also trained better to actually identify child abuse and be able to verbalize what's going on in a legal system, sometimes better than the teachers who may not always report as often as the nurses are required to do. Thank you.
Mr. Savani.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Fairclough. I made a note, and we will add that to the group of people that we meet with in the local communities. Obviously, consumer protection, fair business practices is part of protecting Alaskans. Typically, our section has done things that typically you think of as unfair business practices. They're they've handled over 400 cases, and I don't particularly care to at this point, point fingers at any one group or another, but I am going to pick out the kind of the unusual group that we have dealt with in the last year, and that is we have we are in litigation with 41 different drug companies for manipulating wholesale prices of drugs, and that affects Alaska's obviously the Alaska population in general, but Medicaid is a particular area where we try to look at savings for the state. We have settled with many of the drug companies, and in March I think we're going to trial with eight that we haven't been able to settle with at this point. Another area that's protecting Alaskans obviously deals with our environment, and our environmental section has been dealing over the last several years, as you all know, with the pipeline shutdown in 2006 as a result of that bottom 20% of that slide, the sludge that was not removed from the pipeline and caused a substantial amount of corrosion. We are going to arbitration on the damages as a result of failure to collect royalties. The promoting responsible development has spent, we've spent a lot of resources on, and actually I do want to mention this, though, that when you talk about a lot of resources, the major portion of our budget, more than half, is spent on protecting Alaska's area that I've just gone over. You're all aware of the litigation, I believe, dealing with Point Thompson, where the lessees leased land for oil development and then for 20 years didn't do anything about it. The lease was sought to be terminated by DNR in 2005, and we're in litigation on that, and from the governor's state of the state speech, who all recognize that about 8 days from now, there's a deadline that he set for the oil companies and the state to try to resolve their issues. Outer Continental Shelf has been an area that's been involved a lot of, well, involved litigation. Here you see two separate federal cases, one dealing with a Beaufort Sea and Shell's exploration there. BOEM is Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, allowed for the exploration of the state. Then there were two separate lawsuits where the state intervened, and those are pending at this time. Similar situation with Shell and ConocoPhillips dealing with the Chukchi Sea, and we intervened in those cases also. Matter is still being litigated, but an injunction has been lifted that allows for continuation of those projects. A state case, those last two were in federal court, but in the state case, there was the Department of Natural Resources made a finding for the lease, for a lease sale. The state has been sued by an entity called Red Oil trying to stop that lease sale. The state has petitioned the Alaska Supreme Court to hear that case, and they've agreed to do that. So that's litigation that we're involved in. This case with Nanantha is... some people look at it as dealing directly with the have a limited partnership in the development of the mine in that area, but it's really substantial. The case itself had potential of being very difficult for any development in the state if NANTA prevails in this case. Basically, what they said is that the Department of Natural Resources had no, would be in violation of the Constitution for them to follow the statutes that you passed and the regulations that they had enacted in dealing with permitting, and that it was a basically tying up state land in violation of the Constitution. We have prevailed so far in that litigation, but it is on appeal. But you can imagine what that does for any time we have a permitting situation if it's unconstitutional because it's a grant, it's tying up potential state lands or waters. Another boring, what sounds like a boring case, but has, again, a lot of implications for the development of any resource in the state, is a case that came out 10 days ago from the Supreme Court, State versus Don Dalton. In that case, the state had been sued saying that the land use plan for the Bristol Bay area had to be enacted by regulation up until, the Supreme Court said no. It's not a regulation. It's a plan to set forth the best use of land for the people in the state, but so that it's not a regulation. It would, if we would have lost in this case, it would have had statewide significance because it would have applied to all land use plans. They all would have had to go through the Administrative Procedures Act. I'm sure you're aware that 43% of Alaska is wetlands. We've been involved substantially with the federal government, with the Corps of Engineers, and the Environmental Protection Agency, who first came out with a proposed guidance that would have put more controls over state wetlands. We filed our concerns about that, so they changed horses in midstream, and they decided that it was going to be a regulation. We are objecting to both the process. We're objecting to the process and we're objecting to the process and trying to keep the restrictions on the wetlands under the regime that already exists. We've been involved in the Tongass National Forest issues, both on the roadless area issue. We've had two separate cases there. It was believed that there was an exception to the Tongass for the Tongass Forest to not have the restriction of the roadless areas. This last year, the district court in federal district court in Anchorage said no, there wasn't an exception to the roadless rule for the Tongass. We're appealing that to the Ninth Circuit. Independently of that, we have filed litigation saying, well, the roadless rule in and of itself is inappropriate, and that should be overturned. We have dealt with the log jam timber sale, where after the sale occurred, there was litigation as to whether or not the sale actually could go through. We intervened, and I think I don't want to speed. We saved over 100 jobs.
You've cleared the logjam?
Yeah, we hope we've cleared the logjam, but more importantly, we've saved people's jobs. We've been involved along with Mr. Sturgeon in dealing with the dispute between the state of Alaska and the National Park Service as to our navigable waters, and we believe that we are in a fairly good posture to get the case litigated. Mr. Sturgeon wanted to operate a hovercraft on navigable waters that went through a state park, which was allowed under state rules and not federal. And so we believe that ANILCO made it clear that the federal government, that we had jurisdiction over the navigable waters.
Bipartisan, bicameral Alaska Legislature Outdoor Heritage Caucus has circulated a letter supporting the Sturgeon versus Salazar litigation. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I want to say thank you for the department. I know you have some wonderful people, not just on the navigability, but also on the RS-2477. Do you also have funds to be able to possibly file other cases as those cases progress this year?
Through the chair, are you asking if we have plans in the works to file litigation?
For instance, on the Mosquito Fork, if you were able to get all the information that was necessary to take it to court, do you have funds to do that, or will you need more allocation toward that?
In our budget, there's $450,000 for outside counsel that primarily would deal with these natural resource issues. So, and we believe that'll work for us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just so people know, although this is not my district, I have minors that do live in my district, and a lot of them will have more permitting that will be required by the federal government, and if we don't start moving on this, they're basically going to be put out of business. So it really is coming to a head to livelihood and economic development in our state. Thank you.
One area that we've been involved with, and to be blunt, we've probably taken our lumps with the press about this area, and that's the Endangered Species Act. We were involved in many different species in what the area, the habitat, should be. Our concerns are the lack of good science being used by the federal government and the overreaching in many areas about whether a species really is endangered. And so we've been quite involved in that and in several different with several different species.
And Representative Wilson, that over the years that I've been involved with the budget process, and it's heightened in the last few years. We have told the Attorney General's office they will have the resources, at least from our side, and to battle both the current administration and the NGOs to make sure that Alaska has, at the very minimum, a seat at the table, so we're not carved up by a combination of federal bureaucrats and non-governmental organizations or mostly environmental groups. And Representative Guttenberg.
Can you tell us if there's any impact on the state's ability to defend itself under the Endangered Species Act since the coastal zone plan lapsed?
Through the chair, I'm afraid I can't. Mr. Cantor's here, and maybe he can answer that question. He can talk to you directly about it. Would be helpful. Okay, thank you.
You want to stab this right now, and so it's not a lingering question, Mr. Cantor?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Let's put a dagger in it or whatever.
Through the chair, Jim Cantor, I'm the Deputy Attorney General for the Civil Division. And one of the arguments that we make in the Endangered Species Act is that we have the state resources and there are other federal statutes already in place that protect species that may need protection. The loss of the coastal zone management program, kind of changed the optics of that. It made it look like something went away. But I believe the protections are still in place. The Coastal Zone Management Program was an organizational program, but the underlying protections, both on the state and the federal side, are in place. And so it's a perception that we have to correct in those cases. If that answers your question, Representative Guttenberg.
Nothing else. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cantor.
We'd like to think and protect the financial integrity of the state, and we like to use this as a good example, the Carlson case. In the 80s, there was litigation over whether or not outside non-Alaska fishers could come to the state, and the legislature had imposed additional costs on them of obtaining permitting. They sued, and ultimately the Alaska Supreme Court said, yes, we could have additional fees if it was consistent with the additional costs to the state of regulating people from out of state. But the defendants, or the plaintiffs in the Carlson case, argued and were successful in arguing that there was substantially more that they were being charged, that it was costing the state and the additional cost to the state. And they want a judgment of a little bit more than $12 million. This case has been going on since the 80s, and in the last 3 weeks, the Supreme Court, after hearing this case for previous times, heard it for the fifth time. And the issue before the court this fifth time was whether an amount of interest, prejudgment interest, that was punitive in nature and really designed to deal with people who weren't paying their taxes, and remember, it's the state of Alaska here, that they imposed an 11.5% compounded quarterly penalty against the state. And as this case worked its way through the system, that amount of money ultimately grew to $62 million. So there was $12 million plus $62.2 million, and then there were attorney's fees on top of that. The Supreme Court, 3 weeks ago, actually the legislature dealt with this issue last session by basically putting the money, all the money in escrow. The Supreme Court, 3 weeks ago, finally decided they were wrong in the 11.5% tax, interest that they were being charged. And this means a savings to the state over the period this case has been going on, something over $50 million. We don't have the exact amount right now. It's remanded to the trial court for a final determination, but our lawyers, in doing calculations, believe that we will save $50 million. I showed you earlier a slide about...
And just for the thing that was just passed out, that was the schematic of the major litigation, not inclusive of every case, but that the budget subcommittee had prepared. So,
sure.
Representative Vera.
Mr. Sabati, thank you. I mean, good work on the Carlson case. That seemed like an awful lower court opinion. So I asked a question the other day to the wrong agency, and I was supposed to ask it to you. So did we do a reopener on the Exxon Valdez litigation? And if we did, is it still going on, or did we not do the reopener? Is that litigation over, or are we still in it?
I'm not sure. I think you probably hit the right agency, but the wrong person. I'm going to ask you. He'll direct either now or later to you. That was
it. Why don't you come on forward, and we'll just dispense with that. Welcome again, Mr. Cantor. Why don't you just stay up here just so we don't have to do the pop up and down.
Through the chair, Representative Garrett, we did submit jointly a plan for restoration, and whether that gets implemented is something that's still being litigated, whether the reopener reopens or not.
I think I understand the question and or the answer, and I'll just ask more questions later on out of the committee. Thanks.
Yep. Good. You can go and stay there, Mr. Kent.
I'm about done, too. Our oil,
I think you're about done.
You may not have even started.
Our oil, gas, and mining section over the years has brought a big return to the state in both in royalties and property tax and in production tax. And over a 10-year period, they have brought back to the state $1.95 billion. If you remember back to that chart that I showed you earlier about the money that we brought in this year, and you add $110 million to this chart, we brought back more than $2 billion to the state in the last 11 years. And yes, if you think I'm kind of excited about that, I think that that's a pretty good return for the investment that the Alaska legislature has made in us in dealing with oil and gas matters. A couple of the oil and gas matters that we dealt with have been the TAPS litigation that there are two cases that are recently in the press, and I believe I misspoke the other day, Mr. Chairman, when I said 2005. It was 2006. It's Judge Gleason, the case that Judge Gleason first dealt with, and then in 2007 through 2009 is her most recent decision, and this really deals with the valuation of the pipeline for property taxes. The decision, the first decision is before the Supreme Court now, and the second decision has just come out. We expect that the owners of the pipeline will be appealing that because it was substantially favorable to the communities that received the property tax. It also affects the state, which is a harder calculation to make because as we get an increased revenue for property tax, we get a decreased revenue in calculating the tariff. But again, it's to our benefit. Judge Gleason's latest decision. We've been involved, and I bring this one up in another tariff issue, which is dealing with the strategic reconfiguration of the pipeline, and I bring it up because it's ongoing litigation that we're involved in back in D.C. right now, and it's substantial. It costs a substantial amount of money to do that, but given our record on returns, we think it's quite worthwhile. Finally, good governance. We have recently settled.
Representative Denberg has a question.
Thank you. From slide 26. The top bullet, state challenges inclusion in TAPS tariff, hundreds of millions of dollars in prudently incurred capital project expenditures. Can you expand on that?
Through the chair, yes. Several years ago, the owners of the pipeline had a plan of basically automating.
Are you talking about the strategic reconfiguration?
Right, yes, correct.
So what part of that strategic reconfiguration were you calling imprudently incurred? And how did it deal with...
Direct your question, just in case.
Thank you.
Through the chair, I'm not quite sure what you're asking me about, but the owners had a plan that for
automating certain parts.
And you're willing to, you're capable to switch attorneys. You're the civil guy, and you're the criminal guy. The civil guy's right next to you.
Well, if I get it wrong, he'll correct me.
Okay.
But I mean, it was like, I actually am going to have to turn to Mr. Cantor for examples, but there were kind of exorbitant plans to, but let me tell you.
Why don't you just jump in, Mr. Cantor?
It was a plan that went awry in its management by hundreds and hundreds of percent in excess costs above what was predicted. And it's our position that project was imprudently entered and imprudently managed. We're presenting that case. It just ended, but it was weeks and weeks of presentation before the federal FERC and the state RCA on the technology of how that project was handled.
And maybe if I can, I recall several years ago one of the pipeline people indicating to me that basically they thought that they could get it down to where it was automated, where a handful of people were going to run that line, and they had basically grandiose plans that once they tried to implement them, went over costs. It would be picking a number, but by a huge amount, and they just didn't follow. They didn't follow good business practices in dealing with the automation of the pipeline.
Thank you, Representative Edgman.
Yeah, just so I can get some more information. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the Judge Gleason decisioning, knowing that her facts were clearly disputed by the various parties, as I understood it, and I didn't read the whole document, the municipal attorneys were sort of over here, the industry was over here, and maybe the state was over here in terms of the projections about throughput and recoverable oil and the life of taps and things like that. But her decision basically seemed to cut through the middle, saying that the life of the pipeline could extend out to, I think it was 2068, there's still 7 billion barrels of recoverable oil, and the throughput numbers I don't quite recall. But where did the state, that decision just being issued, where did the state come down? Where's your position today, or is there a formal position on her decision that she rendered? Because I was confused about that.
If I may, Mr. Chair, the state, the SARB, the board that sets the assessment of the property tax for the pipeline, came up with a valuation that was slightly lower than Judge Gleason's, but more or less in the same range. And we were defending that valuation. The taxing communities thought it should be substantially higher, and the taxpayers thought it should be substantially lower. And so we by nature, by defending the SARB decision, were right in the middle. Her decision came out a little bit higher, but more or less the same, and that's what we will be defending in the Supreme Court.
So, Mr. Chairman, just a follow-up. So you'll be defending whose position in the Supreme Court? I'm sorry.
Well, we'll be defending Judge Gleason's decision, which went pretty much along with what the SARB thought.
Okay.
Yeah. We're going to stop this discussion here. Not to stop it, but we have intent to have a very extensive hearing on litigation as a subcommittee with intent to invite the whole legislature to that to go over, have all the relevant attorneys in the room, not just the two heads, the ones that are here online, to go through the litigation in detail. So we're going through three budgets here today, so I am going to stop it here. And
just a brief question, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Right handed, also. The 06 decision and the one.
I guess I didn't speak clearly. Representative Guttenberg, let's just stop it here because I want to do this in detail, and I think we're not doing it a service. No disrespect, sir, but I'd probably let it go on without.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to say my own defense. This is kind of my one opportunity, and I wasn't trying to, you know, prolong the discussion. I just wanted to try to get a quick
We were very lax on broad ranging. We were going to do it in detail, and I'd rather have them prepared for that discussion. We have three departments today. And
fair enough.
And I've left that schematic of our litigation so that you could think about questions and cases that have interest you. I didn't mean to rush anybody through, but I probably let it go further with that other meeting coming up. So back to the budget.
And finally, protecting good governance in the state. We have recently resolved two longstanding cases that involve both, the fiscal integrity of the state and the well-being of the students in the state. The first case up there is Moore, which was a case where we were initially sued for $1.3 billion. It resolved after going to trial twice with an $18 million settlement that would go into what would fund grants to the lowest 40 to the schools that are the most out of compliance with best child, no child left behind, the people that have the lowest scores with the exiting exams that are done, and it'll deal with early education of children, teachers' retention, and things like that. Moore was actually, it sounds like it cost the state a lot of money, but in the long run, the decisions by, again, Judge Gleason in that case said that there was a plan that was appropriate for rural schools, that the legislature was appropriating sufficient money for us to be passing a constitutional muster. What they found is that when the state was exercising an oversight of poor-performing schools, that they weren't doing an adequate job, and this resolves that case. The next case is Casile.
While we're still in Moore, Representative Jewell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I heard you talk about that settlement in terms of early education, and I wish that would have been the wording in the case. I think the wording went was second year of kindergarten, two-year kindergarten, second year of kindergarten. And to me, there's a huge difference. One implies something about kids in those areas of the state, and the other one really talks about early education. I really wish that would have been the word.
The Chair, Representative Jewell, I'll check on that. My understanding was that it wasn't that it was allowing people to go to kindergarten a year early, and the state would provide educational services for those children a year earlier.
I know what the intent was. The way it was worded had implied something else. And having heard that kind of thing over and over time, I heard it again.
I will get you a copy. It sounds like you, through the chair, it sounds like Representative Jewell, you have a copy of the agreement. And if you don't, though, I will certainly get it to you. And the Casile case deals with school construction in rural areas, and it agrees, or settlement in that case was to build five rural schools over a four-year period of time, and both of those matters will be before you this year. And with that, I think I finished up in about the right time.
When we have the independent, the other presentation, which we'll let everybody know, I think there'll be a lot of questions on the reference case that we got into. I wanted to make sure we have somebody here who can augment, make sure you have the appropriate person that is fully conversant with that litigation. Mr. Cantor. Representative Guerra.
Thank you. I appreciate working with both of you gentlemen. You've been candid in front of the committee, and I appreciate that over the years, so I probably should have said that a while back, but I'm saying it now. And Mr. Svobodny, I don't mean to say this in a bad way. It'll always come out. Whenever you say that, it sounds bad. I have no evidence that your department, the criminal department, does anything wrong in this regard. No evidence whatsoever, really, that I could hang my hat on. But we know from the federal litigation against Senator Stevens that the feds held back information because attorneys get competitive sometimes. They don't all act the way their superiors want them to act. They want to win. And I'm just wondering if you have been able to send some sort of directive to all of your attorneys that withholding evidence that is due to the other side will be dealt with severely by your department. I mean, I have no evidence that your attorneys are doing that, but it seems that there are always the few apples in every agency who will just try to win at all costs, and you can't really control that. So,
through the chair, Representative Guerra, I appreciate you saying that, but I hope you take this as some amelioration in your concerns. We have a meeting, a DA conference each year. And there's a three-hour ethics section each year. And probably more than 50% of that, that ethics lecture deals with what lawyers call Brady material, Brady versus Maryland, and what needs to be turned over. So every year, everyone's getting, all DAs are getting at least probably an hour to an hour and a half of training on that. Secondly, we tell them, this is the rule. If you don't want to turn it over, you have to turn it over. If there's something about it that makes you, I'm not going to say exactly what we say. It's, you have one of those moments, you got to turn it over. I think if we have problems, it's in that there's so much information coming in to the DA's offices or that the police have nowadays that they never had before, that it's just a processing time issue for us. And so when we screw up, and we do, I really think it's more, well, we didn't know that the police had this, or, no one went through 24 hours on an in-car video camera to see that there was something there that needed to be turned over. We have problems. We're working on it. But I hope that I would invite you to come to the next DA conference and see.
Thank you. And just one very brief follow-up. And now you'll probably save the amount of information that they'll have to turn over as long as the police know they can't text while driving. And that won't have to be turned over.
Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Unfortunately, I have some budget questions about this. And
don't contaminate.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Svobodny, you or whoever else is the appropriate person to answer, take these questions offline because I'm not even sure that I can pose them properly. But when I look at the budget book, it says that you have an increase of $9 million in your budget, $3 million of which is in addition to the base, and then $6 million in change is ongoing oil and gas matters. And so what I need to know is this in addition to the amount for ongoing oil and gas matters, or is this a situation in which we just treat it as new every year when we do it? And the second is, why would the $3 million be added to the base, which is what this budget asks for? So, like I say, don't need to answer those questions now, but I would like answers at some point. Thank you.
Through the chair, we'll certainly get you those answers.
Thank you. Looks like there's other questions. Mr. Mayor, since we have the questions about lawyers, I just your predecessor always complained about lawyers. He said the actions of 95% made the other 5% look bad. That was unfair. Anyway, we'll take a very brief at ease while we switch departments. Let's come back to order after the brief recess. It is 2:42, still February 1st, and I'd like to have join us Mr. Wilder while you're here. Speaking with Mr. Wilder, we had an invitation to Judiciary to join us on the budget portion. We certainly would never talk to them about ongoing matters before the court and opinions, and Justice Carpenetti was very gracious, said he couldn't make it because of travel considerations, but he had three issues that he said he would have talked about had he been here. And one was increasing maintenance items, a pervasive problem with a lot of our aging buildings and maintenance and employee security issues. Two, the adjusted pay differential, geographic, which has been an old friend that's been with us. And three, the six court clerks that he said would complete the No Dark Courtroom Project. So those would be his three issues. I might have been quicker than he, and we'll see when he speaks before us who was quicker in describing those three concerns. But thank him for providing me, sent me personal correspondence, but he wanted to share the three points of his budgetary concerns with the committee and through indeed the legislature and addressing the court's priorities. Those would be his. I'm sure you'll bring the cash register bar and a few more before. But with that, your predecessor, Mr. Christensen, is here. We discussed him throwing you a lifeline. He said he'd be more likely to throw you an anchor. Welcome, Mr. Wilder, and please commit yourself to the record.
Thank you, Co-Chairman Stoltz, Co-Chairman Thomas. Thank you for having us here today, members of the committee. I do feel Mr. Christensen's eyes in the back of my head. We worked together for 15 years, and so now I'm taking over his position. And I have with me Rhonda McLeod. She's the court system's chief financial officer. And she knows 10 times as much as I do and can answer questions that I can't. The mission of the Alaska court system is to provide an accessible and impartial forum for the just resolution of all cases that come before it and to decide such cases in accordance with the law expeditiously and with integrity. I suspect that that's somewhat the goal of most court systems. One thing that distinguishes our court system from many courts around the country is almost entirely state-funded, and probably most importantly, we're a unified court system. It means we don't have county courts and municipal courts, we just have a state court system. And not only does that lead to great efficiencies both procedurally and fiscally within the court system, because we don't have a lot of redundant processes in all the in various different counties and things. But because the rest of our state, most of the rest of our state operates the same way, we have, you know, there's one entity that prosecutes all felonies in Alaska. That's the Alaska Department of Law. We have one correctional system. We don't have different corrections in every state or every county. And that allows us to have things like the Criminal Justice Working Group, where the Chief Justice, the Attorney General, the Commissioner of Corrections, the head of the Criminal Division. As a state, we can all sit down together and resolve a lot of statewide issues. That's simply not possible in a lot of states that have literally dozens and dozens of different county courts, county corrections, and things like that. It's a great benefit to our system. I think there are only about 8 other states that have even a unified court system. So this is a great benefit to all of us. One of the things that makes the Alaska court system different within our state system, at least different from some of the others, is we're more like the Department of Corrections. Just like the Department of Corrections can't say, we're not taking any more prisoners, we're full, they have to take every prisoner that's sent to them that's in their custody. The court system has to accept every case that's properly filed, and judges have to resolve every one of those cases. One thing that makes judicial decisions a little different is that judges have to sign a pay affidavit before every pay period saying nothing on their desk has been left unresolved for more than 6 months. They're the only state, or the only employees in the state of Alaska who have to sign such an affidavit. If they can't sign it, they don't get paid. In fact, Justice Carpenet has a story from what he was long before he was, well, he's been a judge for a long time. He was on the Superior Court here in Juneau for many, many years. He had a long, long, very complex murder trial. And he didn't reduce his other cases because he thought he could keep up with all of them. But he had so consumed by that one case that he didn't get paid for like 4 or 5 or 6 months. And you all know Annie Carpenetti from the Department of Law. She eventually reminded him that he did need to get on with those other cases because they did need to get their paychecks.
No, that's probably not a constitutionally enforceable one, but the court system has agreed to follow the directive. And so it's just esoteria for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. But there are, in terms of busy judges keeping up with their work and having to sign these affidavits, there are a number of factors that impact workload. And workload isn't the same necessarily as caseload, but some things are pretty obvious. If the population, if you have a general increase in population, you're going to have an increase in caseloads. That's a pretty obvious one. They don't always track exactly, but over time, a bigger population means a bigger caseload. But there are other factors, too. For example, an increase in police officers or, as you mentioned earlier, Representative Jewell, increase in DPSOs in community. Even without an increase in population, even without an increase in the crime rate, you can have an increase in caseload based on resources and other aspects of the judicial system. There are also some other things that aren't quite so obvious that vary from community to community. The trial rates vary from community to community, both civil cases and criminal cases. If you have a high trial rate, you've got a lot more work than a similar community with the same caseload that has a low trial rate. And then there are some other things that are even less obvious, but just a change in demographics. Even if the total population doesn't change, you've heard for years and you're going to continue to hear for many more years that the fastest growing segment of our population is seniors. Well, the fastest growing...
And a couple of times a year, so Representative Dugan feels at home.
I wasn't going to point out anybody particularly.
I appreciate that.
Yeah, it's also the fastest growing segment of our caseload. Those are is probate, which are wills, estates, and an awful lot of adult guardianships and conservatorships. So all those things affect workload. But still, caseload is kind of the easiest thing to look to see how busy the courts are, and it is the one place you can look to see where trends are. On this slide, you can see Superior Court cases this year are up slightly. As Mr. Savatny said earlier, we see the same thing in terms of felony rates. Our felony rates, I think, are up a little this year, but they kind of surf along, up a little bit this year, down a little bit, but they have not changed dramatically in the last few years. But also consistent with what Mr. Savatny said, we have domestic violence restraining orders are up again this year. that is a portion of our caseload that does tend to go up. But from a management perspective, I think the most interesting aspect of this slide is two-thirds of all cases originate in South Central Alaska. Well, this creates somewhat of a management issue for us because we, and in the same way the legislature struggles with not passing legislation that is too kind of Anchorage-centric. If all the, you know, if two-thirds of our cases come from Anchorage, Palmer, and Kenai, it's easy to see all solutions from the perspective of Anchorage, Palmer, and Kenai. Just like you don't want to pass laws that only make sense in urban areas, we don't want to pass rules, policies, and procedures that only make sense in Anchorage. A lot of our rural court judges chime in vocally when they say, this makes absolutely no sense in Nome or Kotzebue or Barrow. So that's a challenge we have. When all your most of your cases are in one area, the challenge is not to only think of solutions that come from that one area. And to point that out, we have 800 permanent employees. Most of those are clerical, but they're in 42 different communities. They're not just in Anchorage, Palmer, and Kenai. We have 8 appellate court judges. We have 42 superior court judges. They're located in 13 communities. 23 district court judges in 9 communities, and 43 magistrates located in 27 communities. And many of those magistrate courts, in some locations, it's just a part-time magistrate. There's in many of those cases, they're the only judicial officer in town. And in those communities, it's particularly important not to think that every court has got a lot of staff and superior court judges in them. Some of those are very small, and the procedures and rules we adopt have to work there. And this chart is pretty self-explanatory. It just shows you, like the legislature, the court system is a very small portion of overall state spending. And how do we spend that money? Well, if we look at our FY 12 funding, like many entities that you fund, we are primarily, our biggest section is personal services costs. The next biggest, but by far smaller, category is services, those things such as leases, utilities, other costs associated with those facilities, jury fees, software support, security contracts, those types of things. I just note here that travel, although it's a very small portion of our budget, it's 87% of that travel budget is jury travel, and then travel of mostly judges, but other court employees as well, just covering courts around the state. If the judge, this is a huge issue in rural Alaska in the Second Judicial District, if the judge in Kotzebue, Representative Jewell, is bumped, the judge may cover from Nome or Barrow. It's expensive to travel out to those communities. In terms of our positions that you funded last year, the biggest source of those new positions last year came with Senate Bill 58, which added 2 new Superior Court judges and their accompanying staff, and I thank the committee for it, and Mr. Chairman, for the support on that bill. And since passage of that bill, those judicial positions are being staffed currently by retired judges, and you may or may not have heard that last week the Judicial Council forwarded to the governor 13 names to fill those 2 Superior Court positions, plus the Superior Court position left vacant when Superior Court Judge Sharon Gleason joined the federal bench in Anchorage.
Do we have a vacancy or pending or on the Supreme Court?
Mr. Chairman, we do. We have a vacancy created when Judge Morgan Christian moved to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals.
And where are we in that process? Is it
they are Mr. Chairman, they're advertising for that position now.
We're going to get 10, 15 names for the governor pretty quick.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I suspect when an opening on the Supreme Court comes along, you get a lot of applicants.
Like it to the governor? Or?
Well, the Judicial Council will decide that, but we'll see how many go up. I'm sure there'll be a lot of applicants. And I think, I don't know if 13 for 3 judges is a record with this last, but it is a lot of positions going up.
there are a lot of applicants. And then, as mentioned in the Chief Justice's note to you, Mr. Chairman, no dark courtrooms. You funded the last 4 years of our requests. It's a long-term, multi-phase process of adding more clerks to the courts. This year, we're asking for the final installment of 6 of those. In terms of our other funding requests from last year, well, when I asked for that bill last year, Senate Bill 58, for the new judges, I mentioned that we're not just adding new judges when we get busy. There are other things we do to try to more efficiently manage the cases we have. And last year, you provided funding for some special projects on how to better deal with cases involving children. Those have been very successful. We have a retired judge who does settlement conferences. We have a new settlement program that uses volunteer attorneys that has a very, very high success rate. Last year, they handled 161 cases. 80% of those settled. That's been a very successful project. And it's projects like those that we hope delay the amount of time it is before we're back asking for new judges. New judges is the most expensive way to solve case management problems, so we do try to find other ways to do that.
As the members probably remember from the stack of fiscal notes on that, it permeates a lot of other agencies in all branches. So it doesn't always do good to wait a year because, again, here was looking, Mr. Wilover and Mr. Christensen were looking for one judge and put them off a year, and then they had two judges they needed. So these guys are like wolves at the door.
Part of our secret plan was to come back with 3 the next year, but we didn't need to do that. In terms of what we're asking for this year, we're asking for a total general fund above our adjusted base of $2.5 million. Again, part of the big chunk of that is the final phase of the No Dark Courtroom, those last 6. As the Chief Justice also mentioned, a geographic differential, as you may know, in fiscal year 12, contracts that the state entered into with its labor contracts, they adopted a 2-year phase-in for the geographic differential. The legislature has typically matched, given similar pay and similar geographic differential to court employees. Last year, you provided the first phase of that, and we're asking for the second phase in this year's budget. We have got $500,000 we're asking for. Next carriers for essentially maintenance items, increased costs for utilities, leases, security contracts. We're also asking for an increased lease payment. We'd like to go out to bid for a new courthouse in Mnemonic. And looking for 5 additional positions that I have listed here in the subcommittee, I can go into some detail about each of those, but a magistrate trainer, security analyst, a contracts leasing manager, a record technician, and a probation officer.
Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Wolver, I think you said Mnemonic Courthouse, the written material says Mnemonic Courthouse expansion. You said a new courthouse. Are they the same thing?
Through the chair, Representative Dugan, yes. We're looking most likely, hopefully, at a new courthouse in Mnemonic.
I see. Thank you.
Thank you. The other items we have here for the last 2 items in our funding request, computer replacement. We have right now in our budget $425,000 a year for upgraded and replacements of upgrading and replacement of computers. Our goal has been to have $600,000, so this asks for the $175,000 to bring us up to that level. And then there's a $200,000 transfer for treatment funding that has been part of the mental health trust funds that we're asking to be transferred back or over to the general fund.
What's your Thomas?
Thank you. Are you going to get a color copier when you replace their computers?
Mr. Chairman, they actually gave me a color copy for just this morning, which is pretty nice. I left it in my office because I was kind of proud of it. But,
no, we need to get your own machine so you can have color copies. He brought a copy around. We couldn't see what it meant.
So, he's trying to match his colorful presentation.
Yes.
It looks nice up there, though.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We're also looking back between FY05 and FY13. We've been asked to kind of explain the kind of nature of our budget increase over that period of time. As I've already mentioned, of course, the biggest portion of our budget increase over the years has been in the personal services line, the main one being salary and benefit increases over the years that the legislature has funded for both other state employees and including court employees, pay raise for judges. Second largest component in the increase since 2005 as part of that section as well is that we've added a total of 8 Superior Court judges since 2005 and 3 District Court judges and their accompanying staff. And then finally, as mentioned earlier, the staff added for the NODAR courtrooms makes up the other big chunk of the personal services line increases since 2005. The other area where we have seen some significant increases would be in the services area. Those costs are generally maintenance items, increased leases, security contracts, software support, utility costs. Also in 2010 and 11, the legislature moved all the costs associated with therapeutic courts from both the court and the other agencies into the court budget to better account for those. So we have a new separate appropriation in our budget that we didn't have prior to that. The next slide just kind of breaks out what I've just been talking about. Biggest change, salary adjustments, increments. We have a separate category there for NODAR courtrooms. Technically, those are increments, but we just pulled those out since we have been specifically asking for those as a separate item, as a separate project. And then where
that
we...
That doesn't make it an increment?
I guess I'm...
Mr. Chairman, it is an increment.
So there's no technically about it.
It is an increment, yes. We highlighted it separately just because it has been a separate project. We wanted to show you what percentage of that, of our increase has been that particular project.
So Julian and I like straight talk here.
Yes, and nothing incremental, Mr. Chairman.
And then where do we go from here in our 10-year plan? In general, our 10-year plan anticipates being able to handle whatever workloads and statutory changes and caseload changes come along. As I mentioned before, the variables that affect that are things that we don't have a lot of control over, so our plan is necessarily vague in that regard. But we do, in general, anticipate growth, although... As you all know, both from redistricting and just in general, the biggest area of growth in Alaska is South Central. And we anticipate that most of our future needs and development will be in South Central Alaska. In the near term, our busiest right now courts are Juneau, Bethel, and Palmer. We're not asking for any new judges yet, but just a heads up, it may be that we will need new judges in those communities. But in the long term, and again, this is the growth in South Central Alaska, particularly in the valley. As the population out there grows, the justice system needs will grow. And those needs will be reflected in our needs as well. And I imagine not next year, probably not the year after that, but in future years, we'll need more judges. They'll need more prosecutors. There'll be more police. That area of Alaska is growing, and we anticipate a lot of growth out there. There's one last project I want to mention that's part of our 10-year plan. This is our electronic document management, which is typically called e-filing. It's in our capital budget, but I want to talk about it here because it is kind of the way of the future for our court and courts around the country, and it will have a profound impact on the way we manage cases and the way we transmit documents. This allows people including state agencies, to submit their filings electronically. The change could hardly be overstated. When you go from a paper system to an electronic system, you make an awful lot of changes. There's a lot less data input. Every time clerks enter data, there's the possibility for error. And the more you do that, and right now, we input data, public defender inputs data, the Department of Law inputs data, all sometimes on the same cases.
When I talk to the Public Offices Commission, I think they've got all the kinks worked out.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm aware that these projects sometimes take a while to work properly. But this is a multi-year project. There'll be lots of requests. The federal government does this now, but it is going to be a big change. We hope it leads to a lot more efficiency, a lot less error. Ideally, you have things like we have right now in some areas of Alaska where the police write tickets. It's an electronic ticket. They fill it out electronically, and it automatically goes into the court system. It automatically populates our database. And if the person pays online, not one court employee has anything to do with that case. And it used to be everyone that comes in, somebody's got to type in all that data. Well, eventually all of our documents will come in this way. And one of the great benefits of that is when you move from a paper system, right now if there's a file somebody needs and it's sitting on a judge's desk, that's the only place it is. It's not accessible to anybody else. Of course, an electronic system, everything is available at all times to all the authorized users. It's a big project. It will take years. But all courts are moving in this direction, and we will be too. That's all I have for you today. I'd be happy to answer any questions if I can.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Waldor, back on page 18, where we were talking about in the near term, you might need new Superior Court judges in Juneau, Bethel, and Palmer. It seems sort of counterintuitive to me in terms of the Juneau court, because my understanding is that the population in Southeast Alaska is shrinking rather than growing, and if that's true, and the crime population follows the overall population, which several people have told me over the years is true, why would we need another new Superior Court in Juneau?
Through the chair, Representative Dugan, Juneau is already a very, very busy court. In fact, Juneau has been requesting that we ask for a new Superior Court judge last year and this year. But they are primarily because they are one of the busiest courts. They're still staying that way. And it is true, my understanding from the Department of Labor Statistics, that the long-range projections for Southeast Alaska is a general decline. Right now, they are still a very, very busy court.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Anything else? Representative Costello.
Thank you. Through the chair, my question has to do with helping me understand the process for when there's a vacancy in a court. So what is the rationale behind having a council forward names to the governor?
Through the chair, Representative Costello. Well, of course, it's in our Constitution. The idea at the time is called the Missouri Plan. The attempt is to take politics as much as possible out of the process. And it is, so there are members there that are appointed by the governor, there are members there that are sent by the Bar Association, and then the Chief Justice sits as the official head of the committee, only voting in cases of a tie, which actually doesn't happen very often. And then they screen all the candidates, they interview all the candidates, they travel to the community where the vacancy is occurring, and then and interview members of the community about those people. They take public testimony on all of those, and then they make their decision about of all the candidates who've applied, who are the best qualified for that particular seat, and then they forward those names to the governor.
A follow-up question? I don't know. It seems interesting to me that the president doesn't have those constraints, and we have a executive branch with a governor that has powers in our Constitution, like line item veto, and I know it derives from the Constitution, but to me it's always been a puzzling situation that we do have a governor in Alaska that has certain powers that give that office quite a bit of you know, power and, you know, the direction that the state is going. And one of the main ways that the governor can influence the direction is through the budget and through you know, appointments to you know, in the Department of Law that have long-standing impacts on the state's future. So I've always found that to be interesting, and I know we did have a governor who turned away the names that were forwarded by the Judicial Council, and so apparently that's allowed also, so there might be some flexibility.
Through the chair, Representative Costello, the governor attempted to turn away those names, but he was left with those names in the end and made a selection from them. But the framers of the Constitution wanted specifically to keep a check on the governors. You're right, we have one of the strongest governors in the country. His powers are pretty extraordinary compared to a lot of other governors. But the framers wanted specifically to have an independent judiciary and not give him the power to also appoint all the judges.
One final question. So as you move to the e-filing system that you talked about, will there be a transition period where paper is also accepted while you transition into the e-filing, or will it be sort of a light switch that goes on and off?
Through the chair, Representative Costello, I imagine it will be a long and painful transition. Because you're right, you can't just all of a sudden say, I'm sorry, we're not accepting that. Yesterday we would have, today we're not. There will be a transition period, and we'll have paper, and we'll have electronics, and it'll... Yes, these projects are difficult, and some people just decide they want to do something else and work on these projects. But, you know, they're inevitable, and we try to do them as best we can with as little disruption as possible.
Thank you.
I think and Representative Costello brings up the frustration. It is in the Constitution, while the public thinks we have, and the governor have more voice than we do, and that's part of the frustration. And I know for me, one of the frustrations is on the appointments to the Judicial Council. The public members are submitted by the governor and confirmed by the legislature, yet the Bar Association just gives a list of names. That's I remember when Yul Kilcher used to come down here on a regular basis. He goes, I didn't write the Constitution. It was me and a bunch of damn lawyers. But with no disrespect.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman.
You might
I have
you.
To respond.
I mean, they weren't all damn lawyers. As my father was one. But on the other hand, I agree with you. It was a bunch of lawyers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I was trying to be historically accurate with Mr. Venture's quote, with no disrespect to either of the parents of my colleagues.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Venture.
A quick historical note, given that we're about to hear from the new Wendy Redmond, it's very nice to hear from the new Christensen. So.
Representative Guttenberg.
I wonder if Mr. Christensen can give him a report, a grade.
I don't know. I don't want anybody to complain about grades. I don't want to start a big argument here on grading. So, and if so, please grade on a curve, you know, in fairness to Mr. Boulevard. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
It's very brief at ease.
Good afternoon. It is 3:25. We're in House Finance, Room 519. Juno weather, when I have a gavel, I usually try to give a report. Looks like it's clear right now, but maybe the temperature is dropping and everything's melting around here, so wear your rubber boots. We are resuming our House Finance Committee meeting, and my co-chairs have passed the gavel. We are not killing anything, but trying to accomplish something by putting the overview to full finance together with the subcommittee review, of which I'm chairman of that particular process. President Gamble, if you'd introduce yourself, and at the table with you, Michelle Rizik, and then continue into your presentation for us. With the support of the committee, I would like to try to conclude this presentation by 4, no later than 4:15. But certainly that's dependent on questions that you might have. If you do have questions, we are having a subcommittee meeting that we can follow up with that tomorrow, too, if the questions are very that need a little bit of time for response. With that, Mr. President.
Madam Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity here today. I'm mindful of years ago when I would watch a big four-engine jet land as the commander of a base or a squadron, and 100 to 150 people would get off. The inspector general team would come in to give you one of the three or four annual inspections we got every year. It seemed like we just lived from one inspection to another. They would always start off with the team chief by saying, "We're here to help you," and I would always respond, "And we're so glad to see you." and that kind of reminds me of sometimes of the way we get into these conversations. But on a more serious note, well, for the record, first of all, I'm Pat Gamble, and I'm the president of the University of Alaska System, and I have with me today Ms. Michelle Rizig, who is our budget officer, sort of on steroids, because Michelle, as you might suspect, does a lot more than just work the budget in terms of helping with strategy and programs. I'm also mindful today that this is the second time I've come before you, and the last time I got off pretty easy. The last time I was new, the last time I was probably in some sort of a little bit of a honeymoon period, I had a lot of talk about what I needed to do, and a year's gone by, and now it's accountability time and responsibility time to step up and say what we are doing and what direction we're heading. My job in this, building the budget and those programs that go with the budget in order to move the university forward, is to lay out the markers out there in the future someplace, and then work the staff and work the culture as it turns out in some cases needs to be worked in order to achieve those futures. When I was here last year, I told you I couldn't see more than about 2 years out in front, and so I was going to bring in a budget that was markedly different than the growth budgets you had seen for a decade. It was going to be relatively flat. It had no capital program planning money in it. It had no money for capital programs in the budget, and that I was going to do this for 2 years while I assessed the university and figured out what I needed to do. You gave us a lot of thinking. Looking through the transcripts and the meetings that we had before, it was clear where your interest lay. I would say at sort of the tactical level, we had an array of interests that came from the committees, both on the House side and the Senate side. Dealing with those as we went back to make sure that we were picking up on those interests has been a part of what we've done for the last year. However, between what you all had your interests in and between what I and the staff took a look at and what was happening across the nation, not just across the state, but across the nation with regard to the concern for education, we have a huge job ahead of us. And as a result, the effort that's underway right now, and it's significantly underway, it's been underway for months, and we'll talk about a little bit of it today, but mostly probably tomorrow, Madam Chair, depending on your wishes there. It's a complete change in direction of the university from what it's been. I mean, it's a rotation on its axis. It's not a strategic plan, which is what we talked about last year, but more a change in the direction of a moving entity that's picking up a different approach toward outputs as opposed to just wanting to grow and fund the items that would allow growth, or in other words, inputs. We're going to be much more output-oriented. The idea of a return on the investment and the obligation we have toward the state and toward our students is much more central to what our whole initiative is about than anything that I talked about last year, because I just simply didn't have the visibility on the size of what we had to undertake. So with that as a preamble, I'm going to go very quickly over the budget today, but underneath that budget that you'll see today, is a whole lot that we can talk about in many other areas of your interest and many others that we've discovered. The first slide is the there's an overview slide. Yeah. Next is our mission slide. The thing I would like to point out about the mission slide is whatever we end up doing, whether it's large scale, you know, strategic level, or whether it's tactical, The mission statement is talking about the emphasizing of the North and its diverse peoples. And we can tend to get caught up in the cosmosity of some of these big things we're looking at, but the adaptation of what we're seeing to Alaska for Alaska's needs, including Alaska's diverse people, has to be an undercurrent that runs through everything we do, or we will lose sight of our own mission. And nobody yet has told me that that mission statement has changed. So the mission statement is a very important slide. It occurs over 22 locations. On this slide right here, a huge physical plant, a huge fixed plant. Who are we? We're just coming up on 35,000 students. We're just about there, 15 nationalities. And we're integrated into communities all over Alaska, many of whom have no road access. And those represent opportunities as well as challenges. We have over 500 degrees across the community campuses and across the major campuses, if you count anything that is a degree, not a certificate, but a degree, like a AA degree or a baccalaureate degree. We have over 500 degree programs for almost 4,000 graduates in FY11. Why are we here? Well, I think we're here for Alaska. If we were sitting in the middle of the lower 48, surrounded by other states in the Midwest, our students would come from a lot of different directions, and they would go out to a lot of different places, businesses, different homes. They would have opportunities for a lot of different schools, both community colleges and large campuses that surround them in other areas. We are here relatively isolated except for the E-world. And so we much more, I've come to notice in all the data that I've looked at, we much more are Alaska's university. And really, that's the answer to the question, what are we? We are Alaska's university. So when we look at Alaska's needs for Alaska students, the cost of doing business in Alaska, the linkages to the job market in Alaska, and where we need our graduates at every level, we are much more Alaska-centric and focused than any other university I could find out there, including places like the University of Hawaii. Performance-wise, we are still growing. As you can see right here, all these indicators are wonderful except the one I'm most interested in, and that's flat as a pancake. That number, 27.8% at the six-year graduation point, is not acceptable, and it's one of the main tenets of our program that I would talk to you about. We call it the Strategic Direction Initiative, or Change in Direction, or SDI, and it's one of the main tenets of SDI. That's got to improve. You know, we're not supposed to bring the Red Book in. But in order to talk a little bit about our budget, in compliance with the idea that we shouldn't bring the Red Book in, we do have a camouflage book. And in the camouflage book, we do have on the left side the Board of Regents budget, which really represents the budget that I presented to them, and it went through unchanged. So it's really the budget that I saw at that particular point in time that goes along with what I just described as the principal needs that we heard that we could probably take on this particular year. And those principal needs are reflected on the left-hand side. So you see advising in there. You see a level of research that's research for Alaska issues. The bottom line on this budget is we've got a tough road ahead because the only thing that survived was $215,000, which goes into the baseline for our honors programs at UAA and UAF, longstanding programs with the best students we have in both institutions, and that went into the baseline, and that's a good thing. The Sikuliak over in the bottom right, the $547,000, that was cut out too. That had gone to zero, and we had to go back and make the point, look, the National Science Foundation is building this 261-foot state-of-the-art research vessel, and we made an agreement that we would operate it, and this is the first year we're asking for operating funds. If they see that we're not willing to fund that, and of course, we're not asking for that money from the legislature. That was going to come out of UAF's hide right there under receipt authority. But that was taken out. I mean, if the National Science Foundation saw that, we would risk losing the ship in Alaska. There's no question about that. Or they would turn it over to a university that has a pretty extensive fisheries program Dartmouth comes to mind, and they would come up here and operate the ship in Alaskan waters. And we got some traction with that argument, and so we got that back in. The guidance was come in with a flat budget, and we did. The academic program portion of our budget, which is in the middle on the left-hand side there, was a representation of a 1.8% increment over last year. And virtually all of that was cut out. So as a percentage, it turns out that we're going to get a 0.01% increment raise, and that's not going to be real helpful. So we are in the process of trying to figure out how we're either going to reorient internally, or we have to come back and argue for the programs that we had talked about in so much detail last year. As we did last year, we wanted to come in and say, look at what we're doing first for ourselves before we've come in and asked for the dollars that we thought we need, which, by the way, amounts to about $6.1 million in total is what we were asking for that was cut out in our program area. The cost savings initiatives, we ate about $7 million in the health plan, which represents an increase in our employee health plan, which we internalized as opposed to coming in and asking for those dollars. We're in the process of looking at executives, and as people retire or take other jobs, we're consolidating and reducing the number. We're looking at, and there's some examples there, we're looking at personnel savings wherever we can. My office, when I walked in the door, had 9 people. In June, it will have 4. It has 5 right now. It will go to 4. So where we can, we're trying to reduce personnel because that's a dollar earned immediately when somebody walks out the door. And if we can reorder and pick up the load, that's a dollar saved and a dollar that doesn't have to go back in the budget. We did a dependent audit. This was interesting. We looked at our health care program and brought an auditor in to take a look at how many people in our health program were not eligible for our health care program. And about $500,000 worth of in the dependent side, where, and it wasn't anybody trying to hide anything. It's just that with the way people, you know, go through time, and suddenly a young adult becomes an adult instead of a dependent, and but yet it doesn't register in the system, and so we're still paying out for those kinds of folks. We looked at all those examples, and we got back about $470,000. We were just talking about the importance of reduced energy consumption. That goes without saying. We're putting up video screens. We want to make them like a telephone call. As ubiquitous across the system, we've put up dozens of them, and already in the first year we've saved $500,000 in travel just by virtue of the fact that we're not all ganging on the airplanes anymore like we used to. High-demand jobs were where we focused the ask, which is represented in the green box down the bottom. So 3 million of the 6.1 million we were looking for in programs was specifically in this area. I will mention an interesting thing. We talked about this last year. When you start linking jobs that are available in Alaska to what we call high-demand jobs, to the interest that students have in education, and what that salary expectation is going to be when they graduate and actually go into the market, because they're looking at that not only to make a living but to pay off their debt. There's a very, very interesting matrix that you can go through as you look job to job to job. For example, if you're studying to be an architect right now, the unemployment rate for architects is very high. It's a tough road to hoe. You're going to incur a lot of debt. You're going to go into a world right now where nobody's building anything, and the unemployment rate is high. When that changes, you will see in the media, and the salary, by the way, is low right now for an architect going in as a result of all that. When that changes, you will see that salary go up. But what really is amazing is if you have a master's degree in architecture right now, not only can you find a job, but the salary is way out of proportion with the growth in salary that you would see from a start to experience to a master's in many other career fields. So there's anomalies out there now as a result of the economy and the way it is. You can go into a business where there are jobs in Alaska, but you might not make much money to start with. Your starting pay is going to be low. Teachers are a great example. you stay in school and get a master's degree, you're going to see a significant bump in your pay. And that represents, for teachers, for example, one of the best ways forward is to continue their education if they can, to get to that level where they can pull, where they can pull maximum pay. We here's another one we talked about last year, economic development and intellectual property. We were talking about it last year. We're actually into that now. I have a nice glossy from UAF that shows in bar graphs the number of initiatives now that they have going forward, the number of patents that they're seeking, the number of spinoffs that they're working on right now. It comes out of the University of Alaska Fairbanks Office of Intellectual Property and Commercialization. UAA has just started theirs. It's a little different version. It has some innovations in it that UAF doesn't. We're sort of seeking out what's in the art of the possible in this particular area. Again, we were looking for a little bit of seed money on that one. Unfortunately, we didn't get it, so we're going to have to work that one. So not much to talk about on the O&M budget. I mean, there's really nothing left. So we'll take the same focus on the capital budget. You remember last year we said deferred maintenance was the number one priority of the university, consistent across the line. It was reinforced two board meetings ago when our board chair, Fuller Powell, at that time asked myself and the three chancellors, what is your number one priority across your entire domain? And they answered first, it's deferred maintenance. Clearly it's deferred maintenance. So we're back again with the same problem. You all supported this last year. We came in with a proposal to sell bonds, pay for them ourselves, $100 million worth. We gave you that really neat chart that explained all the relationships. And we got the $100 million from you all, and unfortunately it was reduced to $50 before it was signed into a bill. We put that $50 to work. But that doesn't go away. The number still, and it bumped the curve, but if we don't do it again and again and again with regard to the annual inputs for 6.7 million square feet of aging floor space, the big curve, deferred maintenance, just simply resumes its slope and continues on up. So we're back again talking about deferred maintenance, renewal and repurposing. This is the step before something goes to deferred maintenance. When an old building gets a facelift, maybe you pull up the asbestos tile because it's all beat up, but when you get to the point where that non-friable tile has to be pulled up, you've got to bag the building, and it's very expensive, and so you wait till the last minute to have to do those sorts of things. If you don't, then ultimately the whole building starts to become deferred maintenance. Big ask right there. In other words, last year we asked for $50 million for R&R. That's the sustainment number that it takes to maintain our 25-year-old building average from year to year to year, and we got two. That was good. We put it to work, but it ultimately kicks the equivalent amount back up into deferred maintenance for the following year. So we're back in asking for we will receive, hopefully, the governor's 37.5, which is year number,
I think
it's year number three, right? Three or four of the governor's promise to help us reduce deferred maintenance. But the number's so big that the rate of increase annually equals or maybe even a little bit exceeds the governor's intent to try to buy down the total. That just treads water, is what I'm saying. And it doesn't touch R&R. We can use it for one or the other, but it won't work for both to move the needle. So we're asking for a big number there, $202.2 million. None of it made the budget. And then the deferred maintenance chart just shows the size of the problem that I just described here. Our annual operating budget is in the neighborhood of $30 to $32 million. We foot that bill. Once you approve it for us, you know, then we turn around, we put that to work on our buildings. And as we discussed last year, when you have a deferred maintenance number that big, in an unprogrammatic fashion, you end up digging into your execution year O&M budget to try to put patches on things that are in the deferred maintenance category because they're failing. This is just a reminder of that what we call the mother of all charts. The two parallel lines, the white line and the green line, show what happened. Last year, that white line was what we told you we could do if we got everything that we came in for, that it takes to get us to a sustainment level on our facilities. And with what we received last year, it moved us over into what now is the green line. So everything shifted to the right. You can see in the top green line, we got a little dent down in the slope. And if we were to be successful in succeeding years, you would follow that green line down on the chart to where it levels off, and that's what we call sustainment. And we'd reach that in about 2018. Last year we said we could probably do it in 2016, but we moved to the right. If we don't do it, the dotted line represents the rate at which we right now estimate the deferred maintenance overall gross number would continue to rise. And again, this is probably maybe not the place to go into the details in this chart. We can maybe do that tomorrow at another time. But this really is the chart that guides us in terms of what we ask for when we come in here because of the relationship of O&M, R&R, and the impact on deferred maintenance. I read an article the other day where the person writing the article talked about, you know, if the state doesn't do thus and so, the state's deferred maintenance bill will reach $800 million in the next couple of years. We're approaching that point already just in the university. It's a serious problem. So in our capital budget, once again, you don't see any money for planning. You don't see any money for new buildings in there. We were only asking for deferred maintenance dollars and for R&R dollars, and none of it made it. We did get the federal receipt authority for capital projects, but that's just the ability to move some money around internally, which we will do. But the right side means that on that chart, in the preceding chart, we'll go to the dotted line for another year because it won't have any impact on deferred maintenance or R&R other than to kick it to the right and add to the totals up in the top. So we've got a challenge. Last year, with that $50 million and the governor's $37.5 million and some money that we put in, we've got a lot of projects underway right now. I mean, we put that money on the street as fast as we got the bill signed, and all three universities and the community campuses are all very, very busy between the Title III money, between the TDOT money, and between the money we got in deferred maintenance. We put a lot on the street for contractors, and all across the system, there is good work being done. One of the hallmarks that we pushed real hard through the chancellor's efforts was when we get a dollar, put it to work. Don't let it sit. And that was the case. So that's our bottom line. It would really be nice to be able to talk about a systematic way to approach this problem rather than coming back every year and talking about gloom and doom. There's a businessman's approach to how we could work something like this. David Teal, we've talked to him. There are some ideas that we have that we could discuss in further detail. But if it's a battle every single year, I know who's going to be the loser, and it will eventually come back to haunt us when it becomes such a problem that we start having mission failure, which to me is mission failure is when students can't go into a class and sit down and learn or get online and learn because something is broken down. That may be in their dorms, could be in the classrooms, or it could be in student research for a project that is in a research building that has a bad leak into the electronics and kills something in a petri dish or a fish tank. There's a lot of that over on the research side. So that's the general area of my biggest worry right there. Research for Alaska. Again, we went after specifically what we were hearing Alaska needed in terms of research output, whether it was going to come from the university or it was going to come from the federal government or whether it was going to come from whoever. There are certain things Alaska is saying we really need answers to these questions. And so we put in a request for research that was pretty healthy. And it was all research for either Alaska-specific answers to Alaska-specific questions, or it was answers to complementary programs that the federal government is looking at because of a growing and increasing concern with regard to the oceans or the Arctic or something large where we're sitting right in the middle of the controversy and really should assume a preeminent position for doing the research and controlling the grants. And we can do that. I mean, that door is wide open for us to be able to do. That money didn't make the cut. Speaking of federal agencies, we're getting more and more recognition. I mean, that's really a credit, I think, to the quality of the research that's going on. Some of it is cutting edge, and I've had the chance in the last year to sit with several groups that have come in from other universities, well-known universities, where they also are doing research. And when they outbrief, they sit down and say, you know, you really have some cutting-edge research going on here. And I think it surprises them because, you know, they kind of think of University of Alaska being out there someplace. UAF in the scientific area has probably got the significant lead. But when they come in here and actually meet the people doing the research, they've seen a couple of papers. They want to see for themselves what's going on. Their platitudes and the credit they give our folks is really heartwarming. So, and the government is no exception. We're starting to see more and more interest on the part of the U.S. government to have us do research for them. And so when we ask for the state research, we're looking at complementary dollars as opposed to trying to substitute for government dollars to take some of these things that the national government wants us to do, and of course they're very specific, but sometimes there's some side bets that we're really interested in doing that aren't funded in the primary grant, and so we ask for those dollars to see if we can complement the work that the federal government's doing. We talked about the impacts of research, and of course, you know, very commonly you'll see a dollar invested leverages so many dollars. That's real common to use among research universities. But I think the thing people forget about is indirect cost recovery sits on top of a grant that we get, which is money, this revenue that comes to us that is considered an additional revenue source. So when we write grants, we take that, and if we have to hire somebody additional, that's where the money comes from. If we have to buy a piece of equipment that's outside the grant, that's where the money comes from. Move a couple of walls in a building to create the lab, and it's outside the grant, that's where the money comes from. So it's a degree of flexibility that's very important to us, and it's not lost on us that when we're looking for federal research grants, we're also counting on the overhead that comes with it. Overhead is obscenely high. I mean, I don't know why. It's been like that apparently for a long, long, long time, but it's really good for us. And if the federal government has made an agreement that they think that's okay, it's certainly okay for us. So we've got some challenges, like other states, but not near as desperate as other states. Trending down is relative. We're flattening out is probably a better way to say it. We're not spiraling down like other states. We're basically lowering the slope of the curve from the growth phase of 12 and 14% a year. We're flattening out. I think the state average overall, I read some places like 3.25 or 3.5. We're down in this budget below that. We do have a huge facility complex. If this were a corporation, we would look at closing facilities. That's what corporations do. I don't think that's an option in Alaska. So we're stuck with that. We're stuck with making them more efficient, maybe, but the idea that we would actually go out and close facilities like community campuses and concentrate degrees online, or there's a lot of ideas out there that could move money around, but the question is, if we are Alaska's university, what does Alaska want? And as many of you know, we're out asking that question right now all over the state with our outreach meetings. Enrollment's still going up, but they're not coming out the other end fast enough. And that's the problem I mentioned before. We've got an expansive degree program, and I'm looking very closely at that. Why do we have so many degrees? And I have to be careful because I don't want to intrude on educational space and try to diss anybody's courses or diss any student's desire to get a certain kind of education. But what I'm seeing on the national level over and over now is this idea that we can't be everything to everybody. And with the third dimension of e-learning, you have a lot of options that just even 5 years ago you never had. And so we tended to add courses. But maybe somebody else can give that certain course that it costs us too much and we're not getting much out of in Alaska in terms of graduates. This gets into some real sensitive cultural issues in the academic world. And it's very, very clear that the work that we're about is going to have to change some cultural ideas about what kind of a university we are. We're going to have to work through that. I don't think we have any alternative. Healthcare costs are unsustainable. Just make the statement, I don't know what to do about it. We're working on things like a smoke-free or tobacco-free university to try to reduce healthcare costs as much as we can. That audit of the dependence that I mentioned, but these are probably not going to fix the overall growth that we're faced with. That $7 million that we ate, that I said we are not coming to you and asking for, I don't know how many times I can do that before I finally run out of ways to absorb those. That was an annual increase, by the way. That was a one-year increase. There's a limited solution set to these challenges, as I'm sort of hinting around here. Program reductions, degree offerings, We think that tuition is not going to be a something that is going to have, I use the term free fall, turn it upside down. You know, unlimited growth, I don't think Alaska would put up with that. So if we put tuition increases in a band that says somewhere around CPI, which typically is 2-2.5%, and will probably go up as the economy improves, let's say we stayed that as a bottom end at the top end. We're somewhere near where we are now, 5-7%. Let's say we limit ourselves to that. Then the money, significant dollars, have to come from some other source. Program reductions in program review, class size changes, that's an efficiency thing. If one professor can teach 30 as opposed to three professors teaching 10 in a large course, that's efficiency. Also makes a difference in dollars. Facility closures, I don't know. Do we want to close facilities? And I'm not talking about the ones that are falling down that we want to just tear down. I'm talking about facilities where we have activities going on. We need to go out and find new revenue sources. By the way, we don't normally write grants for academic programs. We have always done scientific grants, research grants. We took a shot at starting to write academic grants, and we struck gold and almost the first time out of the chute when we recently picked up a $15 million grant for teacher mentoring. It was a matching grant. It was a federal grant. We had to come up with we only had to come up with $1.5 million to get the $15 million grant. And it's teacher mentoring, which, if you read the national statistics, really makes a difference to young teachers. And it's reflected in the ability of their classes to test at the level that experienced teachers or classes are testing. So this is a great opportunity. It's a validation grant. It goes to the four biggest school districts in the state of Alaska. The money doesn't come to us. It goes to the districts. It goes to district teachers, and the program is set up by the feds. We're going to write more academic grants. This is an area that we can mine and get that overhead and actually maybe orient some of these grants toward the programs that we're not being able to get fully funded. We've got to increase graduation rates. And then workload increases. We're seeing that commonly in the lower 48. There's this big argument in the culture between research and classroom time. And if you look at the state of Texas, they're probably going all the way to one extreme where the governor has said, I don't care anywhere near as much about research. I want the classroom time. I want the $10,000 degree. And that just about takes research out in favor of classroom time. There's a sweet spot in there someplace for us here in Alaska, and we need to work that as well. So as I mentioned before, meeting the challenges, when we finally took a look at all the stuff we had to do, we realized we need to get our arms around this in some rather large-scale program because it really filters out to the entire university, out to every single one of our campuses, and touches just about everybody. And so SDI is what we came up with, Strategic Direction Initiative. It's output-oriented, it's student-oriented, and it's trying to take the hurdles out of the way of being able to get through our system for whatever purpose that you enter it into, whether you're a non-traditional student or whether you're a four-and-go. We've got to look at ourselves very, very carefully and find out where are we slowing people down or becoming bureaucratic or not treating people with service like we should, which lowers the value of the degree they get from us. So we decided one of the things we needed to do was go out and ask Alaska that question. We've gone externally all over the state and asked communities. Now we're in the process of doing the same thing out in the same communities, but we're going internal and we're asking our students, our staff, and our faculty, what do you think is at the root of many of these things? What do we need? What are we doing good? What do we need to do better, with an emphasis on the better?
President Campbell, it's 4 o'clock, and I am trying to conclude by 4:15, and I appreciate the cooperation of the committee. Our co-chairman needs to step out of the room. He has another appointment that's waiting and had one question that we wanted to ask now or a comment.
Thank you.
Representative Thomas.
Thank you. The question I have is the research vessel. Somebody made a comment going to put it in Seward, and in Juneau here, Senator Stevens built this big NOAA research center. Why don't you try to work those things together? I mean, having research in one place and another elsewhere, you know, it seems to me that we're not trying to maximize or utilize the research potential from the NOAA Center and your research vessel. Just a thought. I mean, if it's a dock, build a dock here, but I don't see why you'd have your scientists at two ends of Alaska. And thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. We can make sure that that's included in some conversation a little bit later so that the committee understands fully the purchase and the agreement that we've entered into with the federal government to bring that research to Alaska. And then if we could follow up then with Representative Thomas's concern or at least comments regarding co-locations of facilities.
Madam Chair, the rest of the slides really talk about strategic defense, or SDI, the direction initiative, and maybe because this is a budget overview, we can save that for one of our other meetings to get into more detail, or I can finish out whatever you'd like to do.
Please continue. We'd like to have the full presentation as you intended. The committee members have been holding their questions so that we can make sure that we submit them quickly or have a little bit of time for a little bit of that exchange right at the very end.
Okay. The next couple of charts talk a little bit about what we're doing right now, what we are already about. We call it the three critical years, your senior year, your first 2 years in college. There is the heart of the target envelope where so much happens that we need to be engaged in. You can't do everything everywhere, but that's a target-rich environment with so many things going on that if we focus along with the school districts in that area, we have the biggest chance of moving the needle, and that's what our program is fundamentally doing. And you can see underneath that bullet the kinds of things that that we're looking forward to. When I say removing obstacles to students, if I go ask a group of students, and I've done this, what drives you nuts about the way you go to school here? What kind of a hassle factor do you have to put up with? It's amazing the responses you get back. They're not the same as the staff, believe me. And transfer credits is one. You've heard the answer so many times, you know, 97% of the credits transfer, but when you hear the stories, clearly something's not right. And when you go to the students, you find out what it is. So that's part of what our outreach is all about. Graduation rates, that's pretty simple. That's a business. That's a business initiative, and the faster you can get the students through, assuming that you know, especially the four-year students, the ones that have the potential for graduating in 4 years, that lowers the cost per average graduate and lowers the cost of debt. The advising that students are getting about these kinds of business calculations is not good. Because we don't have a suite of advisors, we don't have a database yet that will allow all that to come together and sit down with a student and connect them with what we can offer, how much it'll cost, what the job prospects are going to be at the end for this degree, this degree, this degree, what's the unemployment forecast, what's the starting salary likelihood. We can't do that. And if we do, it's somebody doing it on a more volunteer basis or trying their best with a paucity of data that is available to us that we just need to roll up into this program. We put up a considerable amount of money for advising because this was the year we were going to kick off the major advising program across the entire system. And so we put up more than half of the dollars to be able to start that program. And as I said before, all the dollars, including ours, were taken out. So that's going to be problematic. The last slide, this is just an example. One of the things that we've gone out with, it's called Stay on Track. It just simply says to a student, look, come in, take a look around, declare a major, take 15 hours, and then let us guide you through so that you get out in a four-year time period, and then explaining all the advantages that accrue to the students in doing so. I mean, you know, when you calculate a rent buy, for example, you, as an analog, you can calculate, okay, if I stay in school this many years, here's how much I pay and here's the debt. If I get out and go into the workforce and make this much money, here's how fast, you know, I can get into the workforce and how fast I actually buy the debt down. And where those curves cross, and that's the sweet spot, we ought to be advising along those kind of lines, and we have no capacity for doing that. We have academic advisors, but they are in departments, and in a lot of cases, they're beyond the first 2 years where the core courses are. They're more into the more advanced courses. So Stay on Track is actually getting quite a bit of notoriety. What's the interesting thing in there is 120 degree credit programs. We took a look at how many of our degrees take 120 credits, and we found a whole lot of them that take more than 120 for no apparent reason that we can find. And comparing with the lower 48, many schools give the same degrees for 120 hours. Well, if we're telling them to go faster and then we're moving the goalpost out farther, that's got to stop. And so we are in the process right now of doing reviews, and UAF, I know, for example, has already started backing off on some of their courses to get them to 120. We will do that on a much larger scale before we're done. And with that, Madam Chair, I'll stop.
We have an opportunity for a small amount of questions. I had Representative Guerra, followed by Representative Dugan, Guttenberg, Wilson, and Newman, then Costello. And let me see if I can get that written down real fast. Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I tend to be much more, I lean much more towards the Board of Regents request than I think we usually have the votes for. So I guess I'm the bigger spender and you don't have enough votes for what I want. But in a world where we're constrained by money, you have your priorities, and I know there are more, but they're sometimes new buildings, they're deferred maintenance, and there's instruction, right? And at some point, there's going to have to be a cut somewhere. I don't see any new buildings in your budget. People had been talking about the engineering building. So two questions for you. Can you do the engineering work you want without a new engineering building? And then, you know, maybe there can be some sort of commitment from the university. If you don't need new buildings, which were always $80 million a shot, if you don't need new buildings, maybe we can get you instructional money, which I personally think is more important. So I don't know if you can give some sort of long-term commitment on buildings that might make the committee more comfortable to put more money into construction and deferred maintenance.
Sure. Let me take a shot at it through the chair. There are, of course, there's a wish list, and it's a growth wish list. But there's one set of buildings, the engineering buildings, that present us with a bit of a problem. We have a demand for growth in engineering, and we're also beginning to get accreditation pulses that our facilities in engineering are not keeping up with the quality necessary to graduate engineers today. The technology, what goes on in engineering labs, we're kind of old. So the idea that we can refurbish that and fix it is one option. The other is that we're maxed out in terms of the floor space in the buildings that we have, And while we could go in and refurbish, if we really want to meet the growth in engineering that we're forecasting, that has been going and that we're forecasting, we're going to run out of room. And if we run out of room, that will be an accreditation problem, or we'll just have to cut off engineers. So it's a problem because you nailed it. There's $200 million worth of engineering buildings in round numbers, 180, 170, 200, but, I mean, that's the guess. If I drop that into my capital program and I talk to you all about deferred maintenance like it's the number one priority, it tilts the capital program like that. And so we had a session and we said, what hurts the most? And the answer was deferred maintenance is going to have a bigger impact on us than not doing the engineering buildings right away. That doesn't mean that it's not our number one academic priority right now. It is. Engineering is the number one academic priority.
Representative Guerra, follow up.
That's good enough for now. I know we have time constraints.
It's a dilemma, and we're kind of looking for some advice on how perhaps we can handle it. But I did not want to load it into the capital budget, so we didn't.
Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. President, I guess is how we would address you. I do have a question about deferred maintenance, and it's a question I've been trying to ask everybody that I can ask this of, because every sort of public body that I'm aware of is sort of saying that they've got the same problem. They've got a whole lot of deferred maintenance that they have to catch up on. You've got to, you know, fix stuff. So what I want to know, and what I would actually ask for you to provide for the university system, is some simple explanation of how come, if the maintenance was being done, why are we having so much deferred maintenance? And if it hasn't been being done, why not?
President Campbell.
On the first part of your question, maintenance has been being done. We have a number that we typically will put toward the number of buildings, and in fact, new buildings during the growth phase were accompanied through you all by adding dollars, O&M dollars. Now, of course, new buildings have a reduced O&M cost because they're new, and then they sort of pick up, and they kind of level off for a long time until they hit about 25 years, and then things start to happen. That's been covered pretty well, actually. It's not bad. The second half of your question, why not? I'm sorry, I can't answer that. All I know is we're not the only ones. That the schools in the lower 48, several of the well-known universities, Ohio State University, for example, said, we will not build another building. We've got to take on deferred maintenance. Maine froze tuition and said, and our focus is deferred maintenance. We're going to freeze tuition, but we're going to turn around and put everything we've got into deferred maintenance. So everybody's out there trying to work their version of the problem. We are not that bad off. In my estimation, we can get ahead of the game by programmatically working the R&R and deferred maintenance piece before it gets to the point where we have to do drastic things or have a drastic failure. The lightning rod issue in deferred maintenance, in my estimate, across the entire system is the power plant in Fairbanks. That is a roll-of-the-dice issue, and that, much like the engineering buildings, is a dilemma for us because that's an even bigger number for a single facility. But for whatever reason, during the growth phase, the emphasis was much more on newer buildings, to grow to accommodate new programs with newer buildings, and we did that successfully, and as a result, you know, UAA has far less O&M costs, for example, because it's a newer campus than UAF, as you would expect. But now those chickens have come back to roost. Now it's time to go back and pay the piper, and that's where we are now.
Representative Dugan, follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. President, what that does is it imagines a world in which you have to make a choice. Either you have new buildings or you have deferred maintenance, or you have maintenance. If that actually was the choice, nobody ever said that to me, and I would expect that nobody at this table had heard that before. So, as I said, I'd like to have some sort of a written explanation of how that happened, not necessarily to shoot anybody, take anybody out and shoot them, but to be able to understand how all of these chickens are coming to roost at roughly the same time, and why the people who were in charge of creating and managing these facilities, not just yours, but all over the place, didn't do something about their maintenance obligations in the first place. It's just, you know, I suppose in some ways it's an academic question, so I don't expect you to come up with a miracle answer, but it's just baffling to me to hear one organization after another come into the Finance Committee and talk about these huge deferred maintenance problems that they've got. So, and rest assured that you're not the only person I'm asking. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Dugan. I would put the mirror in front of our face on some instances, and as a side note, say that for the 3 years that I've had the university's budget, there has been larger requests for maintenance dollars. Last year was a huge request that that we did not move forward on, at least jointly with the other body. Again, trying to remember that committee members have been in their seat since 1:30. Representative Wilson and Representative Newman have told me that they would submit their questions in writing so that we can make sure that the university is prepared for tomorrow so that we can incorporate those. Tomorrow's agenda on Thursday will include research, distance education, K-12 partnership, the Fisher Report, and a 10-year strategy. So it is a large agenda, but we certainly can try to incorporate over the next week any conversation that you might want to have. Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I wanted to talk about research and some of the findings that have happened around the state, Northern Waters Task Force, some of the issues about the Arctic port and a lot of those other issues, but we're going to take them up. But this is the stay-on-track slide that we're looking at, right? So we're talking about students taking fewer credits than they need to graduate in a four-year period. And you're talking about part-time attendance. When you talk to them, what did they say? And what are they telling you? Why aren't they taking the 30 credits? And why are more of them doing part-time school? What is their answer to that?
President Campbell, the short answer, if we could.
The answer from the students begins back in high school when they pass a qualifying exam and everybody says, great. They kind of back off. They finish their required courses their junior year, and then they float their senior year. And then they come in college, and people tell them, you know, college is tough. Don't load yourself up. You may not know what you want to study, so why don't you take a few hours, find yourself, kind of check a few things out, see how it's going, see if you like it, try online, and then when you finally are ready, you know, you can go ahead and orient yourself toward what you want. That has something to do with the answer that I would give you. The students themselves also like discretionary time. I came from the Air Force Academy. It was the coin of the realm. If you tell them to take 12 hours, they'll happily take 12 hours, but they're not going to study on the weekend. They're going to have their high school lifestyle on the weekend. And what we're trying to say is, look, there's a student ethic we're trying to instill in you. Load up 15 hours a semester times 8 semesters, 120 hours, you graduate, you go into the workforce. What's so hard about that? Let's do it. And we're here to help you, and we'll stay with you every step of the way. You change majors, we're not going to let you make a mistake and take courses that don't apply. We're going to stay right with you. We're trying to change that mindset around. I have no doubt that some people would argue with me, but I have heard students talk like this because I've talked to them. I'm sure all of them don't feel that way, but that has a lot to do with it.
Representative Guttenberg, follow up.
I know there's a national dialogue that's going on about the value of a college education and what you get after it. If you put in your 4 years or your 120 credits and you get out of it, what is... you know, what is the wage that you're going to be earning? Did that education pay for that? But, I mean, here it's obviously part of the dialogue is the lack of understanding of the students because you don't have enough counselors. There's a cost-benefit analysis for the student, maybe not using that term for them, but this is what you're going to owe out of 4 years, this is what you're going to owe out of 6 years. Is it because you don't have enough counselors on point?
In my opinion, that is a part of the answer. It's not enough counselors. What we need to use is technology because you can't have enough counselors for 35,000 students. But we can get data all the way back into high school and populate that data, and the students love to talk electronically. They don't like to sit in and talk one-to-one like we are. They'll say anything electronically, and what we want to do is take advantage of them to populate their file, and then a counselor can maybe have 200 students and be looking for keywords and looking for signs that there's a problem. If everything's okay, you know, the students are moving forward, everything's okay, but if there's a problem, that they can spot it and intervene before a student makes up their own mind that they're going to either do something expensive, which is going to lengthen their time, or maybe quit, where we could help them out financially, for example. And I do have a couple of examples where we've actually intervened and saved some students who are about to make an unadvised decision because the advice they're getting as they come in the door is not the kind of advising we're talking about being able to supply them with the program that we're trying to initiate. It goes way beyond that.
Thank you, President Campbell. I'd like to just thank, again, Representative Wilson and Representative Newman. They both deferred, and I saw one note getting passed. If you could let Laura Pierre, my chief of staff, know what the question is so that we can make sure that we can provide all information back to all committee members, that would be helpful. Representative Costello.
Thank you. I appreciate, Madam Chair, your willingness to take my final comment, which isn't a question. I just wanted to thank you, President, for including the honors program in your base budget. I've always been uncomfortable with the idea that we fund underachieving minds at one level, overachieving minds at another, and then those that are neither over or under at a separate level. And I think that by bringing that into the base, what I hear from you is that you're saying that as a state, as a public institution that's educating people, we have the same duty to educate those who are overachieving as we do those who may be underachieving. And it's my sincere hope that as the state's largest school district debates that issue tonight in public hearings, that they have the same wisdom that you've come to in your understanding that all students deserve the same level of opportunity, whether or not they are at the high end or the low end or in the middle. So I really do appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Costello, and thank you, President Gamble and Ms. Rizik, for joining us today. Just a quick update. Tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock, Thursday, February 2nd, again, I've provided you the agenda already, both electronically. It's posted, I believe, with the clerk, and we will be in this room again to continue our discussion with the university. I would like to note also that tomorrow afternoon, Thursday, February 2nd, in this same room at 1:30, the House Finance Committee will take up the Department of Public Safety Overview, Department of Correction, Alaska Mental Health Trust, presented by the Board of Trustees. Just not to forget Representative Thomas's co-chair of finance closing thought for all departments and entities that are before us. Our state's budget has been resting on the price and production of oil coming through the Trans-Alaska Pipeline throughput. And I know that you're aware because we've had the discussions before, but that throughput has been in decline to the tune of 7% over a long period of time. And Representative Thomas has been pointing out to all those requesting additions for funds and that are funded by the state that we may face in our FY14 budget a shortfall in revenue and be into deficit spending. And so as we look forward, we just want you to recognize that we don't know how we will sustain the current budgets that we have once we move into that level of production or price. But again, Alaska has seen different days and prices of per barrel of oil of $1.50, but we do take the issue of sustaining a budget very seriously. And just wanted to pass that along. Did I do that well, committee members?
Absolutely.
With that, we're adjourned. Thank you.